Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, June 3rd. With me now, Jamil Zlarty, a New Orleans-based staff writer for the Marshall Project, the nonprofit news organization that covers criminal justice. Previously, he worked as a reporter for The Guardian, covering issues of criminal justice, race, and policing. Jamil was a member of the team behind the award-winning online database, The Counted. Remember that? Talked about that a lot after the incidents in 2014, Eric Garner, Ferguson, Missouri, etc. So The Guardian started The Counted, which tracked police violence in 2015 and 2016, after it became more of a public thing that there was not a national database. He's got a deep context piece now on the Marshall Project site that asks if the moment we're in was preventable and compares different police departments' different approaches. It's called Why So Many Police Are Handling the Protests Wrong. Welcome to WNYC. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you. Thanks, Brian, for having me.
One thing in your article is simply about police clothing and accessories, like showing up on mass and riot gear before there's any trouble. And you quote the former Camden police chief and a criminologist named Edward McGuire on that. Can you start there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there is research on this from as early as the 1967 Kerner Commission, which was this landmark federal effort to investigate the urban unrest that the country was seeing in places like Watts and Detroit, and to try to gain some purchase on it. And social scientists found then that this kind of abrasive police behavior, both in kind of appearance and demeanor and action, can be really pivotal in turning peaceful demonstrations violent or destructive. And it recommended that police eliminate those tactics and establish ways for citizens to address their complaints against the police. And studies have continued to find this through the years, right? This is not a new thing that we're just discovering. This is half a century ago. And so when I'm asked why police are have been bad or at least unevenly good at de-escalating tense situations, I think the simplest answer has been that they don't want to, right? They're bad at it because de-escalation is not a core value in most departments. And it appears, and from speaking to a lot of folks over the weekend, that there is this attitude in law enforcement that, you know, it's about domination. And they're either because there's this kind of brash macho bravado among the rank and file officers, they became cops to kick butt and take names and not to coddle protesters, or because at the operational level higher up, there's a belief that policing a mass demonstration is a kind of war, and that there is a real strategic and maybe even life-saving utility in the philosophy of shock and awe, that overwhelming power and spectacular displays of force will paralyze the protesters' perception of this kind of metaphorical battlefield, and it will end before it starts because they just see, oh, well, we're clearly not going to be able to do much of anything, so let's just go home. And I think that all kind of speaks to this overall culture of warrior versus guardian mentality that you often hear in conversations about police reform and the way that police approach their jobs versus the way that a lot of people would like them to. But you know, speaking to retired law enforcement voices over the weekend, I think what I heard a lot of too was that de-escalation doesn't just happen at the protest, and that, you know, this idea of like what the clothes that you're wearing or, you know, the gear that you have, it's kind of too late to just show up to a community that doesn't trust you in light blue uniforms and say sorry. That there's this kind of metaphorical bank of trust, and mm-hmm. if it's overdrawn, it's very difficult for either side to approach it as anything as a war, right? There's not trust that even if you pre-negotiate the terms of a protest, that people are going to stick to it.
Seems like, from what you're saying and from what your article says, that your reporting found camps among police leadership on this idea that a show of force prevents violence versus a show of force escalates violence, and conversely, that a show of de-escalation de-escalates, as opposed to a show of de-escalation communicates weakness and therefore invites more violence. Would that be a fair summary?
I think that's extremely fair. And, you know, I would add that I think those both feel intuitive, right? If you've never studied this, I think both of those ideas make sense. And I would even go so far to say, I would imagine you could find an example of every single version of that, of like that paradigm being true, right? I'm sure you could find an example where police showed up to a protest with such overwhelming force that the protest, or showed up to a protest that where some folks had an interest in becoming disorderly or destructive, and they decided not to based on that. So I don't mean to say that the answer is completely prescriptive and that we know for sure what works in every situation all the time. But what I do think is important is to recognize that there's this substantial, thorough body of research that says that most of the time, this approach does not work and generates more harm than it prevents.
Let's take an example. Jamiles, you write about a de-escalation approach called the Madison model. Want to describe the Madison model?
Yeah, so I write about the Madison model, and a lot of people believe that this is sort of like the original version of de-escalation in mass demonstrations by a professional American police department. And I talked to the chief of that department for 20 years, David Cooper. He's since retired and become a man of the cloth, actually. I will mention that David Cooper is probably not anyone's sort of stereotypical image of a police chief. If you look at, you know, if you Google him, the first picture that's you're likely to see is him at his desk as chief. And I think it's undated, but probably sometime in the early 70s with a picture of Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi behind him on his desk at police. At his desk as police chief, so
not you know, General again, that's, Patton that's not, and et cetera.
Right, exactly. So that's not exactly par for the course. So I mean, I think it's worth noting that his approach was, you know, was not like an intensely popular way of going about it. But so that said, you know, he kind of pioneered in a lot of ways this idea that police officers are sort of social workers with, you know, who have the authority to use force when it's necessary, but that's not kind of the primary reason that anyone should be on the force and not a primary part of the job. And so their approach, they obviously are a college town, and they had a lot of student unrest through the Vietnam War era.
Madison,
and their approach was to, yes, that's right. And their approach was to show up again in kind of the soft clothing with their names visible, their badge numbers visible, to hear protesters out, to listen to their grievances, to be kind of receptive and have that open dialogue, treat each other as human beings. And you know, I asked him, of course, my first question and my first curiosity is me thinking about, you know, myself, okay, if I was an officer and you're telling me you want me to go out there and have this, you know, very vulnerable appearance and approach to people who are angry and who are frustrated and are yelling in my face maybe, and you know, in a background where some of these moments can and have escalated into violence, potential harm that could come to me. How do you get officers to buy into this? How do you get officers to decide that they feel comfortable doing that? And he said, you know, A, as leadership, you show up there too. So you're right out there on the front lines with those officers. And, you know, B, and you tell them, in exchange, we will have the sort of jackbooted, you know, whatever term you want to use, the stormtrooper mm-hmm. Officers around the corner. They're in a, you know, they're kind of hidden from view, right? So you're not trying to make this show of force, mm-hmm. but you have the ability to come and rescue those officers if things go badly. Mm-hmm. But you're not starting mm-hmm. by showing the protesters that you are there to control them.
So that's a great, clear explanation of that. And then on the other side of the divide or the paradox, you write that not all police departments trust that model. And you quote a police official who said it makes crowds, quote, go ballistic. So what's the dispute?
I do just think it's a difference of opinion. And I think, you know, if law enforcement officials have had different experiences, I think it's also fair to say that, you know, maybe the experiences of a college town in the Vietnam era are not the experiences in a city undergoing this kind of strife in the 2000s or the 2010s or the 2020s. So, like, I don't mean to say, again, that there's sort of a clear prescriptive answer. I just want to be clear that there is all of this research and there is some practice saying mm-hmm. that this extraordinary show of force is not the only way and perhaps not the best way to approach a protest and keep things from turning into violence or destruction.
All right. We have people calling in who have direct experience with this. Kurt in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, how you doing? I'd just like to say real quick, as an officer, you have to make a quick and fast assessment of the situation. Then look at the individual as a human being and also have good negotiation skills. You cannot just jump to judgment when dealing with anyone in the street. You have a partner or someone that you're working with who will hold a stand and watch your back and look at your surroundings. And you have to step with confidence and fairness. You just can't go slamming people around. You can't think you're a RoboCop or you saw a good movie or DVD and think that you can do the same thing you saw in the movie. Officers who have a good spiritual and a good foundation with whatever religion or whatever way of life they have, but they have a good sense of soul and spirit, those are the ones who have a longer a lifespan in a department and also with their families. Some officers go home to hostile situations and don't report it. And they come out on the streets and take it out on other individuals, or they have a disconnect with people who don't look like them.
In your experience, Kurt, how widespread is that best practice set or the mindset, really, that you're describing? And do officers talk about this as openly as you just did right here?
They don't talk as openly. And small clusters they do. What was the first part of your question to me?
Just if you think the mindset that you just laid out so beautifully is widespread.
No, it's not. It's you'll find it in officers who practice some type of form of religion or some type of discipline. It might even be martial arts where they've gained enough confidence in their ability to approach people and to deal with people, but don't have to use a hostile or fair, type of mindset. And sometimes officers get into these little groups and clusters, these little cliques, and they make these little sly comments and jokes with each other, and then they take it out on individuals. It starts small, mm-hmm. and then mm-hmm. it grows. And I just have to say this real quick. Some uh-huh. officers come out the academy with good hearts and good intentions, and then they taint it with officers who had bad experiences. And you need older officers who retired to talk to the new officers coming in. I have to go. All right.
Thank you for a great contribution. We really appreciate it. I hope you'll call us again. Tom in Orangeburg, New York. You're on WNYC. Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for calling.
Oh, no problem. First, let me start off by saying I was actually horrified by watching the video of George Floyd. That's not what policing is about. I'm retired NYPD, and I was there for both Crown Heights and Washington Heights riots in New York City. Both of which I came out of there, you know, bloodied and bruised. You had mentioned earlier that one of the tactics would be to put your heavily armed sort of rescue squad around the corner and out of sight. Typically, both sides do surveillance and gather intelligence prior to engaging in disorder. How is it that you can really convince a police officer to go into the front lines with the expectation that there are going to be injuries? There's got to be a better way, and I just don't know what it is. My command was one of the first to attend the verbal judo course that was given, and I've spent a 20-year career without having to, you know, result the, you know, as you put it, jackboot tactics. Sometimes people don't want to get arrested, and sometimes you have to make the arrest. It's the balance that is lacking. And until both sides really understand that there's a level of fear on both sides, the public fears the police officer, and sometimes the police officer fears the public. Mm-hmm. We all have families. We all want to go home. We all want to, you know, sit down and have dinner. And I really don't know what the answer to bring that level of trust on an even keel is.
And thank you for being so honest about not knowing what the answer, Jamiles. I imagine that that's extremely widespread, and it's part of what we're seeing in the conflicted and varying responses around the country today. Anything you want to say or even ask our caller, Tom? Tom, hang on. I'm asking our guest, Jamiles, to respond to you, and then you can come back. Go ahead, Jamiles.
I think I would just say that I think Tom is exactly right in the sense that, this whole approach of, like, the Madison model does not necessarily work when the bank of trust is bankrupt, right? I mean, I think it is an approach which requires there to be some level of trust between a community and a police department and a police department and a community. That's what I heard over and over again, talking to folks about the efficacy of this over the weekend. So, I mean, I think that's correct, right? It just can't be as simple as how you show up, if the trust is already eroded.
Tom, what was it that you were referring to before as verbal judo? What does that term mean?
That was a course that the NYPD instituted in the mid-90s, and it was basically a form of social science where you don't sink to the level of the person you're dealing with. You try to raise them up to yours, using phrases that, like, I appreciate your position, or I understand where you're coming from, and the butt is always where the problem starts, but you have to wear these handcuffs and come with me. There are multiple times where the person you're trying to arrest is compliant, but the people surrounding him are not, and that also escalates the situation. In terms of demonstrations, as a police officer, I've also attended many demonstrations where, you know, you expected things to go off, and they didn't. My 17-year-old daughter attended the Black Lives Movement protest in Nyack on Monday night. Mm-hmm. I was dreading allowing her to go. I was hemming and hawing, and I completely support the movement. But there was also supposed to be a Blue Lives Matter protest going on simultaneously. And to me, that's a match and an excuse. I ultimately allowed her to go, but I also gave her kind of a crash course in surviving a riot. And as a former police officer, it kind of bites at your core that it's come to this.
I hear you. And Nyack stayed peaceful?
I'm sorry?
And Nyack stayed peaceful?
Yes, it did. The protesters actually knelt for 9 minutes of silence, marking the amount of time that Mr. Floyd's neck was compressed by the Minneapolis officer.
That's Powerful. Tom, thank you so much for your contribution today. We really appreciate it. And thank you for your service. And Calder in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Calder.
Hi, Brian. I tried to call in yesterday when you had State Representative Amiri on. And you had referenced the Terrence Monaghan moment at Washington Square Park Sunday evening. I was there.
Yes, and so people know what that is. That's Chief of Department of the NYPD, Terrence Monaghan, who took a knee at one of the protests. Go ahead, Calder.
So as someone viewing that and who's participated in these protests without ever feeling comfortable yelling F the police or F-12, because I just don't agree with that part, it was amazing to watch a situation that where the tension had really ratcheted up in these really tight sort of confines of the park pathways. Water bottles were starting to get thrown. A few people were getting arrested. The crowd was getting really restive. And then sort of all of a sudden, you see this man in a white uniform take a mic and explain with such incredible depth of feeling that there's not one NYPD person who thinks that what happened in Minneapolis or what happens anywhere with these police brutality situations is okay. He said that and took a knee. And the feeling of the entire group of people, everyone there, police, protesters included, the feeling of tension just dissipate was palpable. And it was one of the most powerful things I've ever been a part of or seen.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that. One more.
And hey, all I would add to that is we had a whole line of officers take a knee here at our protest in New Orleans last night on the interstate, and that protest ended without one single arrest. So just another sort of piece of data to throw into that analysis that I think we're all going to be doing for weeks and months. I do think that this is a moment where, and I guess I've been, too optimistic about that before, but I do think this is a moment where people are paying such close attention and we're getting so many data points on, who is attempting what tactics are people trying in response and what is the outcome, that I think there will be, we're going to learn from this moment, new things, or maybe just, relearn some things that we've learned in the past more strongly about how these moments can be best de-escalated and resolved.
Let me get one more from the protester side. I think a multi-night protester over the past week here in New York, Colin in Soho. Colin, we're almost out of time in the segment. Can you do it in a minute?
Yeah, quickly. I just wanted to say that the change in tactics with the NYPD has been dramatic, from openly antagonistic on Sunday to support last night, and I think that has completely changed the demeanor of the protests and sort of de-escalated what could have been a violent situation.
Very interesting. Thank you. And I guess, Jamiles, you're starting to report on incidents like that from around the country. So we just heard from two callers now from New York. You have that, which, by the way, folks, if you want to see more about that New Orleans large-scale taking of a knee by police officers, it's on the top with video, right, of your Twitter feed. I think I saw it there this morning.
I believe so, yeah.
And we're going to have to leave it there. There is so much more we could have gotten into, so we'll have to do this again with Jamiles Larte, New Orleans-based staff writer for the Marshall Project, the nonprofit news organization that covers criminal justice. His article now is called Why So Many Police Are Handling the Protests Wrong. There's deeper history we could have done, like why the 1999 World Trade Organization protests in Seattle were a turning point for things getting more difficult between police and protesters and other things. So thank you for this, and we'll keep following your work.
Sounds good. Thank you so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.